welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program.
I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times.
This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to our Christmas edition of Listen to Older Voices, where we present a special Golden Moments. This program was originally recorded in 1999 and features the then program presenter Morgan Blackrose, who visited the Golden Wattle Club in Hillsville, Victoria. Here she spoke to and with a group of senior citizens, where they swapped fabulous Christmas stories. So without much more of ado, here's Morgan.
This is Listen to Older Voices. I'm Morgan Blackrose and I'm here at the Golden Wattle Club in Healesville to exchange stories about the festive season with a number of older people from the Yarra Valley region. There is an African proverb that says, when an old person dies, it is as if a library has gone up in smoke. You will hear our older storytellers recall the joys and sorrows of childhood Christmases spent during the Depression and war years. The festive traditions that have been passed on from one generation to the next, and their experiences of Christmas now. Listen to Older Voices treasures the stories of our older people, and we hope you will enjoy this collection of stories for the festive season. It was the year that Donald Bradman hit his 1,000th run. It was the year that Farlap won the Melbourne Cup. And when he won, punters sent a telegram saying, if you could only stand up on your hind legs and talk, we'd make you Prime Minister of Australia. These were two brief sparks in an otherwise drab time of gloom and doom. It was the Great Depression.
That's right,
and you remember it. It was a time when the queues of unemployed men grew longer and longer each day outside the factories, outside the employment agencies, and outside the government offices. It was a time when men who'd worn out their shoe leather looking for work had decided they would jump the rattler and head for the country. Not since the 1890s with the First Depression had so many men gone on the track to beg, borrow and steal whatever they could. But there was very little work in the country too. And up until this time, there'd been a rabbit plague. But it was the rabbits now who fed those men and their families. Underground chicken used to supplement their food. Now during this time too, people grew angry at not being able to feed their families, at being evicted from their houses. Houses where police officers had come in, thrown them out, boarded up the doors and the windows, seized all the furniture to pay for rent arrears, and left standing vacant while the previous tenants camped on the streets. And so great unemployed rallies began to occur in the city. Thousands and thousands of people voiced their anger, and they sang songs. We're on the susso now, we can't afford a cow, we live in a tent and pay no rent, we're on the susso now. In Melbourne, the anti-starvation crusade was formed. All over Australia, people were taking to the streets. It was a tough time, and those that were still lucky enough to be in a job didn't know what their future was like. They could lose it tomorrow. So it was for Clancy. Now Clancy had married Jeannie only a year ago and they lived with Jeannie's parents in a little bungalow in Richmond. Clancy was a bootmaker. He was lucky, he still had a job. Those around him had been put off. Now he was always a man who had judged others by the state of their shoes. Whether they were clean, whether the boot laces were a bit tattered. And yet every day as he tramped to work, he looked at the men he passed. How do you judge a man with no shoes? for more and more they'd worn through their boot leather, and they tied rags around their feet and bits of newspaper, whatever they could. But he walked, and so did Jeannie, and she knew that even if her shoes went through with holes, he could always manage to scavenge a bit of leather and mend them. Now it was coming towards Christmas, their first Christmas together. Now, unbeknownst to each other, Jeannie had been putting aside tuppence every couple of weeks in a little tin because she wanted to get Clancy a Christmas present. It wouldn't be very much, but it was the thought. Now, Clancy had also been secreting aside a few tuppence himself in a little tin. He knew what he wanted to get Jeannie. And so as Christmas approached, they both grew very excited, neither telling the other their plans. Until a few days beforehand, Jeannie's mother took sick. So ill, they had to call the doctor. The doctor didn't come for free. So with the cost of him coming, and the cost of the liniment and the tinctures, any spare money they had was gone. Now Jeannie got to thinking. She still wanted to get Clancy the present, but what could she sell? The ragged moan man came round and, well, she had two good dresses left. She could sell them, but she knew that wasn't enough. So one morning, it was the day before Christmas Eve, she walked into the city. She looked around at all of the people. She saw those on the streets, the grubby, mitted, dirty-faced children, barefoot, dressed in rags, and the toffs who walked among them, pretending they weren't there. She saw them all out on the street. And she decided that she would take a little walk down a lane she had never gone down before. She hadn't gone far when she saw a notice that said, "Wig maker. Hair wanted." Now Jeannie had the most beautiful auburn hair. It was always tied up in a bun. It was that hair that had attracted Clancy. He'd seen her with it out. Her beautiful auburn tresses had flowed over her shoulders and down her back. He thought her head was on fire. At night when he would come home for work, he would sit and he would watch as she sat on a chair and unpinned the hair and let it fall down. He watched as she brushed that hair. It truly was a wonderful mop. She climbed the stairs up into the wig maker's shop. There was an old woman, and she had a pair of iron shears. As soon as she saw Jeannie unpin her hair and saw those auburn curls drop down, her eyes lit up. She took those shears, and in three snips, one, two, three, she held the hanks of hair in her hand. She paid Jeannie the money, and Jeannie left. The very bobbed cut just below her ears. She walked straight down those stairs, back up the street to the jeweller's. There in the window it was, where she had seen it day after day for the previous 2 months, a gold fob watch chain. Now Clancy had been given a fob watch by his father, who had been given it by his father and his father before him. It had come down through the generations, but in the passing on of the watch, the chain had gone. And often he would worry about whether he would lose the watch. He'd always talked about getting a right chain for it. Jeannie handed over the money to the jeweller and watched as he put the gold fob watch chain in a box and gave it to her. She went home and she put the curling tongs on the stove. And she crimped her hair very short. She knew Clancy wouldn't approve of it, but when he saw the present, it would all be all right. That night, Clancy was laid off. He should have done the sensible thing, of course, but he had decided he wanted to buy Jeannie a present. He walked in the door, and he nearly fell over in shock. There was his beautiful lass with no hair. "Oh," he said, "what have you done, woman? What have you done? Where is those beautiful auburn locks that I love? She said, sit down, Clancy. I'll make you a brew and I've got something for you. I can't wait to give it to you for Christmas. I want to give it to you now and you'll understand what I've done. And so she took out the box and she handed it to him. What is it? He said. He opened it up and there was the gold fob watch chain. Oh, he said. Oh, it's beaut. Oh, thank you. And he laid it down on the table. I got you something too, he said. He reached into his pocket and he took out a brown paper bag and he handed it to her. What is it? She said. Go on, open it. Carefully, she slid her hands into the bag and she took them out. Two beautiful, diamante encrusted, tortoise shell hair combs. Oh, she said, they're so beautiful. I don't know what to say, but where did you get the money to pay for them? Oh, he said, I sold the watch. On Christmas Day, Clancy and Jeannie joined 12,000 other people and they went to the exhibition buildings and they had Christmas dinner put on by Mr. Sidney Meyer. They came home that evening. They sat at the table and they looked at the mantelpiece, at the gold chain as it lay around the two tortoiseshell hair combs. And there they remained in pride of place for the next 50 years. As a memory of their love and devotion to each other. It was their finest Christmas yet.
Tree tops glisten.
and this is Listen to Older Voices. Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio.
Father Christmas actually originated in the 4th century after Christ was born. There was a fellow called Saint Nicholas. He was the Archbishop of Myra before he became a saint. He was on his way to Nicaea when he passed by a poor man's house. Now, in those times, if a girl wanted to get married, she had to have a dowry. Now, if she didn't have a dowry, then she was probably going to have to live on the street, be either desolate or destitute. This man had 3 daughters, and he was a poor man, and he knew that he could offer them no livelihood. And so there he was at his table. Each one of the girls was marriageable without a dowry, and he was despairing. Now, the Archbishop Nicholas walked past his window and he saw the man. The man was sitting there and he was saying, "What am I going to do with my 3 daughters? They have no dowry. No one will marry them. They will be destitute." Now, he was a very kind and generous man, and he was carrying with him gold. He put the gold into 3 little sacks. He walked past the girls' room where the 3 girls were sleeping, and as was their custom each night, they washed their stockings and they hung them over the foot of their bed. Nicholas threw in a little bag of gold to each stocking. In the morning, the girls found the gold. They thought they were blessed. They now had their dowry, and they could be married, and of course they lived happily ever after. Now, from that very time, the ritual of a Christmas stocking hanging up near the chimney or at the foot of the bed takes place. He became the patron saint of children, Saint Nick, and of fishermen, and of pawnbrokers. If you go to a pawnbroker's shop, you'll see 3 gold balls, which are their symbol, which are based on that story of the 3 little sacks of gold that he threw in. Now, the Santa Claus that we know as Santa Claus, the one in the big red suit with the black boots, he didn't actually come about until 1930, interestingly, during the Depression, and he was created by the Coca-Cola advertisers. They drew him, Father Christmas. They gave him the red suit and the beard, and that stuck because Coca-Cola, as we know, were very powerful advertisers throughout the world, and that's where the big jolly fellow with the whiskers came from that we know as today. But in different cultures there is Saint Nicholas, and in the German culture they have Nicky Nacky Day, or Saint Nicholas's Day is on the 6th of December, so they always have the saint and he brings presents to the children. So different cultures have their own versions of Saint Nicholas, but the Santa Claus that we know him in the red came from that time. I've got a daughter who's 8 years old, and she believes in Santa Claus still. She believes in the Tooth Fairy, and she believes in the Easter Bunny. Well, she's got a vested interest in believing in them all. But as the kids get older, they stop believing. They only need a few older brothers and sisters to tell them that there's no such thing as Santa Claus.
He's not real.
He's not real. He's just that man dressed up, or his dad, or whatever. Somebody else. So I think they grow up fast enough without having to learn that. But the story I'm going to tell you is about a little girl who believed, until the day she died, a very old woman, that Santa Claus existed. And the reason she believed was because she had seen him. The story goes like this. It was a little bush hospital. Now, in the town there had been an outbreak of scarlet fever. Not necessarily a life-threatening disease, but very contagious. It was Christmas Eve and the little bush hospital was full to overflowing. Not just the kids' ward, but all the kids were also where the women were, and the men's ward too. A lot of them were very sick, high fevers, but a lot were recovering. Now, they spent the afternoon, those that were well enough, the day sisters took them outside to the big pine tree that was there in the front yard. Now, the yardsman had got a kerosene tin and a pair of wire snips, and he cut out the shape of a star. and he'd put a lantern in there, and that night he was going to climb up the tree and hang the lantern inside the kerosene tin so it looked like a star from the top. Now, what the sisters had said was that they would have to make the decorations. So they got the Weekly Times and they chopped it all up into little rings and little lanterns, and all that afternoon they spent stringing the decorations around the foot of the Christmas tree. Come dusk, the yardsman climbed up and he put the star right up the top in the kerosene tin. And the kids were very excited because they knew that tonight Santa Claus was coming. One of the other sisters had an old guitar and she had a couple of milk tins that she'd put teaspoons in. She came into the children's ward. She gave out a few of the tins and she told the kids that they could rattle the tins along with the songs. And they sang Jingle Bells and they sang Silent Night. And little May said, "It's going to be wonderful. We've all been good. And everyone knows that Santa Claus comes to good boys and girls." And the sisters, of course, nodded their heads and said, "That's right, that's right. You'll all hop into bed tonight and in the morning you'll find a present under your pillow." Well, of course, when they went for their tea break, they sat around the table, the nurses. All very well to say that the kids were going to get presents, but none of the parents had left anything for them. None of them were really rich, just that, well, there was nothing. Two of the nurses had bought in hair ribbons. Another one started to look through the biscuit tin, found a couple of biscuits. Another had two pieces of fruit, but there wasn't near enough to go around so that each child had something from Father Christmas in the morning. Well, when the sun had set and all the kids were tucked into bed, they went back out and they looked and they thought what they needed was a miracle. Now, a miracle did happen in the little town, but it was years ago. You see, it was again Christmas Eve. It was up in the 90s. There was a terrible north wind and there was a fire that threatened the town. The miracle was a storm that had come. The wind had changed. The town had been saved from being burnt. That was a miracle. But they needed another miracle now. Where could they get presents for these kids? But it's funny, when you say you want a miracle from the universe, sometimes it comes in the strangest forms. No one would have thought it came in the form of Snowy Wilson. The only miracle about him was his liver, how it was still alive after all those bottles of rum he'd drunk over the years. You see, it was Christmas Eve. It was late, and the Night Sisters heard a bit of a ruckus. They went out to the kitchen door, and who should they see but Snowy, his long white beard swaying from side to side, singing with lots of Christmas cheer, "Ho, ho, ho, and a Merry Christmas." On his back was a great big sack. Well, Brown opened the door and said, "What do you think you're doing, Snowy? We've got a whole hospital full of kids here. What are you doing? You're drunk, you silly old fool. Get out of here before Matron gives you short shrift." And he said, "Ho, ho, ho," and he staggered inside. He threw down the bag, and when he did, the floor was covered in toys. There was a train set, there were wooden blocks, there were whistles, there was a Mama doll, everything on the floor. And he said, "You're not going to believe this. Me being a confirmed bachelor and all, I won the Christmas raffle at the pub, didn't I? And what am I going to do with all of this?" And I thought to myself, "Why, them all them little kiddies up the hospital, I'll bet they could enjoy these." So I put them on me back and oh, 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 Merry Christmas. Well, the sisters got down on the floor. They put them all back in just as the matron came in. "What's going on here?" Snowy looked up at her. On her hip was little May. "Look," she said, "it's him, it's him." "What?" said the matron. "It's him, it's Father Christmas." "Go on, Snowy, get out of here right now," she said. "You're making a nuisance of yourself." "I'll get you your water," she said. And she turned around with the little girl and went straight to the sink and filled up the glass of water. Meanwhile, the nurses ushered old Snowy out the door, shut it behind him. But little May could hear him going, "Ho, ho, ho, and a Merry Christmas." The matron took little May back to bed, settled her down. But come the next morning, she was the first one out. "Look," she said, "he's been, he's been." And sure enough, every single child in that hospital had a little present And little May, being the last of six children, had her very own Mama doll. She didn't have a doll at all until now, and she held it in her arms and she rocked it from side to side. "It's Father Christmas, he's been, and I seen him," she said. "You did not," said the others. "But I did see him. I know exactly what he looks like. He's got a long white beard and he's short, but he doesn't wear red. He must have been washing his suit. But I saw him, I did, with my own eyes." And the children all gathered around and listened as she told the story of getting the drink of water and seeing Father Christmas for real. And it happened that until the day she died, little May told that story. And there was not one person in the town who would refute it, for they knew that the Christmas spirit lives not only in Father Christmas, but in each of us. Merry Christmas, one and all.
Rob Greaves here, on behalf of everybody at Wesley Mission Victoria, the Melbourne Community Support Program, the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, and the Toorak Times. We'd like to thank all our guests for being on the program this year, and you, the listener, for supporting us. So from all of us to all of you, a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program, and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.